Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Shalom Aleichem, Assalamu Aleichem, Namaste, Pak Satnam, Sat Sri Akal Tashi Dalek, Ho Lila Tanya Wasiyake. Hello, may everything be well with you as it is with me. Welcome to our class in Post-Lurianic Neo-Sabbatean Kabbalah. And we are preparing today to begin in a new area, having studied Torah for the last 2 months, what Torah is. We will now move on and begin to study Lurianic cosmogony and theogony. Before we do, however, I will do as I do at the beginning of every class, and I will recite the Kaddish for the dead and the mourners of the dead. So I ask you to please close your eyes, bow your heads, and bring into your consciousness your memory of someone who has passed away whom you loved. And in doing so, you will honor this person's memory. You will cherish them. You will honor their lives. And you will keep them alive in the light of your consciousness. Yishkadal v'yishkadash mei rabo. Bomo divero kirase, viamlik melkase, makaya kon uvio makon, uvkaya de kol, bes Yisrael, baagalo uvizman koriev, be imru omein. Ye heish me rabo mavorak, leolam uleol me omayo, yisparak ve yistabak ve yisparar ve yisromam, ve yisnase ve yisadar ve yisale, ve yishalal. Shmeda kudsho beraku, leelo minkol berkoso veshoroso, tush bekoso venekamoso, da ameron beomo veimru omen. Yehe shlomo rabo min shamayo, vekayim aleinu vealko yisrael veimru omen. O say shalom bimromo, huyashe shalom, aleinu vealko yisrael veimru omen. Thank you. To set the stage for our teachings that are to come right away here on Lurianic cosmogony, and I should really say post-Lurianic Neo-Sabbatean cosmogony, because it is the version of Lurianic cosmogony which has been refined or adapted or added to by Sabbatean Kabbalah. And so it's no longer purely Lurianic cosmogony, but instead is a combination. I guess the basis is Lurianic cosmogony, but it has been refined and added to by Rabbi Nathan of Gaza, one of the great, the prophet of the 17th century, Mashiach Yosef Shabtai Zvi. And when I say cosmogony, what do I mean by cosmogony? I mean the word, I guess, literally cosmogony is based on two Greek words, cosmos, meaning cosmos, the universe, the world, you know, all the galaxies, stars, and planets, many universes now that our physicists have been learning more and more about the nature of quote-unquote reality, many parallel universes. And gani, meaning development of, or arising of, coming about of. And so what we're talking about here is when we talk about Lurianic cosmogony, what we'll be talking about is what is Lurianic Kabbalah's views as to how the universe came into being. And that's what we will be studying for the foreseeable future. But it's not just, and I want to remind you of this, it is not just the universe that we'll be talking about and how it came about. We'll also be talking about theogony, the coming about of God. But of course, God's eternal, so he did not come about. Time does not apply to God. So there is no before or after. There is only one eternal now with respect to God. So God did not arise. So what do I mean when we talk about theogony? When I say that we're going to talk about theogony, I mean in the limited sense that we're going to talk about God's manifestation of himself from the transcendent, from the infinite, eternal, unknowable, ineffable, transcendent organizing principle of the universe, if you want to look at it philosophically, and if you want to look at it spiritually and religiously, it would not be ordering principle, unifying principle of the universe, but the transcendental God, which is unknowable by any man, indescribable by any woman or man or person, because this level of God is wholly beyond anything in creation, then what we're talking about with respect to theogony is God's manifestation, his transition, his transformation of at least a part of himself from that transcendental, coextensive being that is everywhere and in everything, that's totally beyond the concept of thing, place, and time, into a human concept of God, the immanent God of this universe. This is what I mean by the theogony. It means the descent of the transcendent God into the world, from beyond the world into the world, to being a God which we can know and to whom we can pray and who will hear those prayers and answer them or not. Okay, having got through those preliminary definitions, I want to set the stage for this before we actually start discussing the mechanics of creation. I want to discuss some concepts here that I think are real important. And that is I would like to try to get you to think about why is it important to even think about these things? Why do we care? Why should we care? Well, we're human beings. And we go through our lives, so many of us go through our lives struggling just to cope with the events that each day and each week and all of our transactions with the world and with other people in the world bring on. There's this outside of us and there's this inside of us. There's what goes on around us that impacts us through our senses and which we perceive on the inside of us. This is the external becoming the internal. And then there's what goes on inside of us. It's what we do in our minds to process those sense impressions and turn them into perceptions and organize them, categorize them, and draw conclusions about them. These are inner processes. And most of us, it's basically all we can do to not even examine those processes and categories, but instead just to deal with what's going on. I remember when I was teaching in college, when I was student teaching in college, and I was serving as a teacher's assistant in a class, and it was my job to answer questions when the professor was gone, and I was like a teaching assistant, and so the teacher was gone a lot, except on the days he lectured. And so on all the days when all of the lab work was going on and things, then I was there, and I was there to help students that had questions. And I remember this one student coming up to me and saying, "I can't understand this concept. Could you please explain it to me?" And I said, "Sure." And I set about to explain the process from beginning through to the middle to the end, and expecting to see a light go on. And I didn't see a light go on. And the student said to me, "I don't understand it. Could you explain it another way?" And I was befuddled, because it was the only way I knew to explain that concept. It was the only way that I could understand it. And I said, "Well, I told this person this," and she said, "Well, that's not good enough. Your job is to make sure I understand it." And I said, "Well, maybe what you need to do is you need to think about this and let it be like a seed inside that is planted in the ground, and let it ferment. And let it begin to grow in there, and maybe things will fall into place." "Well, I don't have time for that. I need to know right now." I said, "Why do you need to know right now?" "Well, because I've got to do this and I've got to do that," all things that were unrelated with this coursework. And I said, "Well, we all have things that we have to do. You know, it's as one of my teachers told me, life is the art of existential juggling. We have to juggle professions and careers and school. We have to juggle each one of these things as a ball that the juggler, who is each one of us, is a juggler, and we throw them up in the air. And we try to keep them all going without dropping any of them. This is existential juggling. We have to put a little bit of energy into each one of them every day, or according to certain schedules, in order to keep them going. Otherwise, they'll fall." And our act will fall apart, so to speak. Okay, and all of these things she was telling me about were all unrelated to this course and to schoolwork. And I said, "Well, those are a lot of things going on." And she says, "Yeah, that's my life." And I said, "Well, then maybe, and I was trying to be helpful here. I was not being cynical, and I was not putting her down. But I said, "Maybe you need to try to work, a little bit on setting your priorities, getting these things that you're doing prioritized in different time slots each day." And that was the wrong thing to say. She became really, really angry and screamed right in my face and said, "Don't tell me about priorities, mister. I've got priorities slapping me in the face." And then she stalked off. And I just didn't know what to do or what to say or what to think. It was a very unpleasant experience. But most of us go through our lives just in a state not very far from what she's talking about. And I've thought about this, you know. What she was saying is, don't tell me to organize my life because I don't have time to organize it. I have too many priorities none of which can be demoted to a lower priority level than the others. They're all number one priority, and they're slapping me in the face. And so a lot of us go through life like this. It's in business management, they call it crisis. The atmosphere in business is one of crisis management. In other words, you can't do any long-term strategic planning because you're too busy. There's nothing to plan for because there's all these fires everywhere that if you don't get a hose on them and a fire crew right now, then the whole shebang is going to burn to the ground and there's nothing left to plan for. Well, that's what we don't want to get in. We don't want to get into that in business. We don't want to get into that in scientific research or scholarly research. Or if we're a writer, we don't want to get behind the eight ball and start missing our deadlines imposed by our publishing house, our editor. Because all kinds of bad things are going to happen. The house of cards is going to come tumbling down. And yet, so many of us find ourselves in this position of existential juggling, where there's too many plates on the end of the sticks. We've all seen the plate juggling act, the plate spinning act, right? Where the guy on the stage keeps putting another plate up on a stick and spins it. And they keep going, and pretty soon they start slowing down. He has to run back and spin it some more and speed them up until finally they're falling, and he's catching them and putting them back up. And pretty soon he's frantic. And we enjoy this a lot. Why do we enjoy this? We enjoy this because on a psychic level, on a psycho-spiritual level, actually, both psychological and spiritual level, we recognize something in that act that is in us. And that is that we are too busy spinning the plates and trying to keep them going to stop and reconsider what we're doing with our lives and whether or not what we're doing has any meaning to it and whether there's any purpose to spinning those plates. Or if we're tossing balls in the air and juggling that way, same thing. These are just metaphors for life. To stop being frantic. And we become driven. And we go through our lives this way. And it's tragic. So many people spend their entire lives this way. On a treadmill. It's like being a squirrel in one of those cages that you see that just runs and runs and runs and runs and never gets anywhere and finally is exhausted and just falls off to the side and lays with its tongue out of its mouth panting in the wood shavings on the bottom of the pen. Well, this can be us. It is us. Too many cases, it is us. So, what I'm asking you to think about is whether or not you have the time to ask yourself the important questions. And if you don't have the time in your life to ask yourself the important questions, I'm going to suggest to you that you're going to come to the end of your life and you're going to be very, very upset and unhappy. Because everything that you've postponed one day, everything that you've postponed, well, I can do that later. I can't do that right now. First, I've got to work really hard to get this promotion. I can put another year and a half into this position. That'll give me 3 years in this position. And that will look okay on my resume so that I can apply for this other position in this other department and won't look like I'm just job hopping and unstable. That'll also give me time to do this networking. And I'm just talking about things in the business world now. And of course, all of us work for a living. And so these things should apply to each and every one of you listening to this. We always put off until tomorrow that which we think can be put off. But what we're really doing is making choices about what our priorities are. And what I'm suggesting to you is that there's only a few things in our lives that really matter. And when we get to the end of our lives, those things will become very, very clear. And do we want to be lying there on our deathbed with the last thoughts going through our lives as being regretful thoughts? Thoughts about, gee, I really should have thought more about this. You know, I've come to the end of my life now, and I'm about to pass on, and I don't know what I did. I can't point to anything I did in my life that mattered. And I'm here to suggest to you that you could be the CEO of a Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 company and have conquered all the businesses in the world, become the head of a multinational corporation. Or you may have won the Nobel Prize, and you still may come to the end of your life and realize that those things that you thought were important weren't important because they didn't really go to the essential few questions. And what I'm suggesting to you is that one of the central tasks of our lives, our short time, you know, our lives are like a river. Our lives are like a river. It starts out as being very small, a tiny drop of water falling onto a mountain slope. And then it runs down and it joins with other drops of water, becomes a trickle, and then becomes a stream, and then becomes a river. And that river eventually flows and empties into a sea. And that's what our lives are like. It's not the sea, but the river. It has a definite length. It has a beginning. It has a middle and has an end. And everything in between. But it has a definite beginning and a definite end. And when we come to the end of our lives, when we get ready to enter the sea, the great sea, we're going to ask ourselves, did I answer the great questions? Because that's what's important in your life. It's our obligation, it's a human obligation to answer some questions. What are these questions? Well, one is, who am I? Where did I come from and how did I get here? Why do I exist? What's the purpose of my existence? Does life have any purpose? Or is it all just an accident? Is it all just random events? We have to answer these questions, or else we're going to be very, at least to our own satisfaction. And if we can't answer them, we have to at least meet our ends in this physical lifespan, knowing that we did our best to think about and try to answer those questions. The regret comes in when one knows that one postponed asking and answering those questions because one always had something that was of a higher priority, because one always had priorities slapping one in the face. Because if you get to the end of your life and you haven't asked or set aside the time to ask and adequately explore those issues, those questions, you're going to realize that your life meant nothing. Because it meant nothing for you to have built that multinational corporation. You're going to die. You're going to pass away, and you're not taking it with you. Those things aren't satisfying. And that's what you're going to find out. They do not satisfy. Fame, money, sexual pleasure, even love does not satisfy. Even love. Because ask yourself, who? It all comes down to the question of who am I? Who is doing the loving? You say, well, I love my wife. We've been married for 50 years. I'm talking about we come to the end of our lives. We've been married for 65 years. and I love her more than anything. Yeah, but what's about to happen? You're going to die. And that love is going to go away. That's right. That love is going to disappear. When what? When you pass away. So we have to ask ourselves, who am I? What am I? And to set the stage for this, and what I'm going to say is that what we're going to study with Lurianic cosmogony is going to apply to personal cosmogony. And it's going to apply to theogony. So we have a continuum. God is becoming. The universe is becoming. Human beings, you and I, we are becoming. And it's all the same. The process is all the same. It all looks identical. Just the form. The forms are different. Now, to kind of set the stage for this, I'm gonna ask some questions here and discuss a little bit about these concepts of identity, this concept of identity. Let me ask you this. Have you ever thought, what is an onion? Have you ever thought, you know, what is an onion? Well, how do you find out what an onion is? You can go online, you can study, it says that it's some kind of a vegetable or tuber or fruit or whatever. I don't know what's online about it in the science books. We know that it's a plant. Okay, but that doesn't tell you very much. That tells you it's a member of a great big collective identity. It's a huge set. It's a member of the set called plants. And then there's subsets within that. There's vegetables, there's fruits, there's trees, there's legumes, there's all these other subsets. Okay, but let's get inside of those subsets. Let's start reducing them down from the giant subset of life down to plant life, down to vegetable, down to bulbs. See what I'm doing? I'm going from the outside and working in. And finally, we go, what? Okay, that tells me what categories and subcategories I can use to identify an onion. But let me look at the onion. So I pick up an onion, and I look at it. On the outside of the onion is a paper-thin dried skin that we can peel off. So let's do that. Let's peel it off. We pull it off. What's underneath that? Well, now there's a somewhat more moist skin. And if we take a knife, we can, or if we, some of us who have really sharp fingernails, I don't, you can make a little cut and you can pull and there's another thin layer and that comes off. And underneath it is another layer and it's a little more moisture. And so we keep peeling and underneath each layer of skin that we peel off is another layer and beneath that another. And we keep on peeling off the layers of the onion skin, one after the other, until we come to the inside, to the center, to the heart of the onion. And what do we find? What do we find? Nothing. The onion is just gone. Okay, now I'm going to propose another analogy. What is the Torah? I'm proposing this one because we've been studying the Torah for the last 2 months. Let's go from the outside in on it. The garments we learned are the stories, or the stories, let's put it, I kind of have it in reverse here. The stories and narratives of the Torah we learned are the garments. This is the analogy of being like a human being, okay? So, it's what the body wears. They clothe the body. So, we go to a level deeper than that. We go inside that, and we find that the body that those stories clothe is the law, halakha. What are these? These are the exoteric teachings. Okay? And what's inside them? Let's peel off those exoteric teachings. So what's inside them? Inside the body is the soul. And what is that? The soul consists of the divine secrets and mysteries. This is what the sages teach. The divine secrets and mysteries. So we peel off the layer of the soul of the Torah. And what's inside of there? The Kabbalists tell us it's the soul of the soul. Yehida ha-neshama. Yehida ha-neshama, the soul of the soul. But what is that? What is that? It's like the onion inside. It's nothing. Ayin in Hebrew. Nothing. And then you say, let's get to you now. You might ask yourself, now that you've seen these analogies of the process, let's turn it upon ourselves here. And you ask yourself, who am I? Well, you might, starting on the outside, you might choose to say different ways of identifying yourself. You might say, well, I'm an American. Or if you want to think, that's if you're thinking nationally. If you want to think regionally, you could say, well, I'm a Southerner. I'm a Midwesterner. I'm a Nor'easter. I'm from Norwesterner, Southwesterner. I'm a Hawaiian, an Alaskan. Okay. Or you might assume, view yourself from the identity of, like, you might say to yourself, well, I'm a registered nurse. Or like me, I would say, I'm a minister of God. I'm a minister of the Lord. An Eved Hashem, a servant of God. Or you might say, I'm an engineer, an accountant. I'm a college professor. But these are all just professional identities. The first category I was talking about, like Americaner, Midwesterner, I guess American would be a national identity. The others would be regional identities. Or if you said, I'm a New Yorker or a San Francisco, those would be city identities. And people think this way. We all do. Or perhaps you might go inside deeper, and you might, like, by removing those layers and becoming more personal, and you might think, I'm a mother of two children, a boy and a girl. I'm a grandmother and have six grandchildren, and I love them all dearly. Or perhaps you might say, I'm a loving, caring person who works in my community for the betterment of people who don't have as much as I have. Or perhaps you might say, I'm a Jew, or I'm a Catholic, or with a slight smile, you might say, I'm an agnostic. I don't know. I don't know if there's God or not. I'm an agnostic. These are all identities. What I'm here to tell you is they're false identities. They're false identities. These are all identities associated with the ego. They're shells. They're skins. If you associate in terms, if you identify yourself with your professional identity, then that's the persona. The persona that Jung talked about. That means that you become that college professor. And so everywhere you go, you're not that young boy that was born to the couple in World War II in Southern Oregon, who went out when he was 12 years old and climbed with his friends in the neighborhood the willow trees and crossed over at the tops of those willow trees, bending those thin limbs down until you could reach the other ones on a dare, which then the others had to do also. You're not that person anymore. Who you are now is a college professor. And you go to work every day, and you teach classes, and you grade papers, and you counsel with students, and you do course development, and work on curriculum development, and you have all of these different duties that you do. And when you go to social functions, you're so-and-so, the college professor. Everybody in town knows you as the college professor. That's not who you are. That's your persona. Nor are you an American. That's nationalism. That's what certain people in our society and in every society who want to control power and resources teach us to identify with through means of propaganda. They want us to think that an American is a different identity, that our identity as Americans is a different identity than Germans or Nigerians or Iraqis or Iranians. But those are artificial distinctions. Those countries are lines drawn on a map. They're not real. Not in any existential sense, which is the only sense that matters. And certainly not in any spiritual sense, which is the only sense that matters beyond the existential sense. The only sense that exists at the core of one's fundamental identity. And when you answer, well, I'm the mother of two children, a boy and a girl, and you feel pride for that, or you say, I'm a loving, caring person who gives to others, and you feel pride for that, or you say, I'm a Jew, as opposed to a Muslim, or I'm a Catholic as opposed to a Protestant, or I'm an agnostic as opposed to all you idiots that believe in God. These are all manifestations of ego. And this is the ego that is the coarse ego. The ego that has that rough shell on the outside. Remember the onion? Remember the first thing I did was I said there's this onion, and I look at it, and it has this dried out paper thin skin. But when we peel it off, we get inside, it gets juicier and juicier. Well, these are examples that I've just given you of gross ego. This is the ego that Sri Ramakrishna described as the unripe ego as opposed to the ripe ego. This is the shell that Kabbalah talks about, the kalipa, the husk, the evil shell that encloses the holy spark. And it has to be stripped away. So we start stripping away and we ask ourselves, well, these are all false identities. Then what is the true identity? Well, then we can say this. Well, I know this. I'm a human being. But what is a human being? We start removing the shell. And you say, well, I know I've got this body. But what is this body? This body is a shell itself, isn't it? It's a cage of clay, as some people have called it. It's a cage of clay. Meaning a cage for what? That implies that something's trapped inside. Well, what is that? Well, it must be our mind. Because that's all that I'm aware of at any given time is my mind. It's what I think. I'm what I think. Wasn't it that philosopher who was the great mathematician and geometer, came up with the Cartesian coordinates, and his name escapes me right now. But anyway, said, cogito ergo sum in Latin. Back in those days, in the medieval times, they had to write everything in Latin. That was considered to be the intellectual language. Okay, I guess in the Dark Ages, you tried to cling on to anything that wasn't dark. And so, so with the light of intellectualism shining, everyone wrote in Latin. And so he said, cogito, I think, ergo, therefore, sum, I am. I think, therefore I am. So what he's saying is I exist because I think. The fact that I think is the proof that I exist. If I didn't exist, I wouldn't be thinking. That's a little bit circular. But, you know, what are you going to do? But does that mean that what we are is our minds? And we take away our mind? What happens if we lose our minds? Well, we're certainly no longer the same person we were. People have strokes and their personalities change. That's unsettling, isn't it? You have stroke and you lose your memory. You no longer recognize people. You have no memory of your relationships. That's something that is very frightening. It used to be something that I was afraid of because there has been in my family some senility. And so you always say that hereditarily that puts me in a higher risk group. Well, I used to worry about that when I was younger. And now I know that that's not going to happen to me unless that's what God's will is for me. But it used to really worry me. Oh, wow, what if one day I wake up and I don't recognize my wife anymore or my kids? They're just like strangers. Every day they come to visit me, they have to tell me who they are. And I have to just accept that's who they are because I have no memory of them, even from the day before. That's the ultimate loss of identity, isn't it? When you lose all your memories. But are we our memories? Is that who we are? No. Because that's a function of mind. Mind is a function of brain, and brain is the physical body. It's a part of the physical body. Remember the onion? What happened when we got to the middle of the onion, to the center? We never found any real center, did we? We got done pulling finer and finer pieces of skin, thinner and thinner pieces of skin off, until finally there was nothing left. When we got to the center of the Torah, what did we find? We found the soul of souls. Well, can you tell me what a soul is? What's a soul look like? What's it smell like? Can you touch it? No, it's intangible. It's invisible. Same thing in a human being. You go down in, you come down to the brain, and you go below that. Inside the brain is the observer, the person that says I, the person who calls him or herself I. I think, therefore I am. Well, Mr. Philosopher, you're not answering who's I? Who is this I that thinks? That right away we have two people. We have a person who's thinking and a person who's observing that person is thinking. So who's this observer? Well, that's the ego. Ego means I am. It's Latin for I am. Who else says I am? Is there someone you can think of in the Bible that said, I am? That's right. For those of you who remember the story of Moses, when he was working for his father-in-law as a shepherd out in the wilderness, no one else wanted to be out there, so his father-in-law put him out there, and Moses said, yeah, okay, that's fine, I'll come out here. And he was out there, and he went up on the mountain of God, and he left his sheep down below. And he went up on that mountain, and he found a burning bush. And he said, oh, I got to check this out. And he goes over to the burning bush, and this voice comes out of the bush and says, Moshe, Moshe. And Moses comes over and says, Lord, I am here. I am listening. And God speaks to him. And tells him, gives him the great commission to go down and free the children of Israel. And Moses says, well, if I go down there and I tell them this, they're going to say, well, what's the name of this God that talked to you? And God said, tell them my name is I am. I am that I am. Eya, Asher Eya, or I like to pronounce the middle he. In Hebrew, Aheya, so that we don't forget that it's there. Aheya, Asher Aheya, I am that I am. So God said, I am. And a human being says, the ego says, I am. So what does that mean? Does that mean that the ego is God and God is the ego? Well, the ego is not God. The ego is a piece of God. It's a chip off the old block, so to speak. When you remove all of the evil shells, all of the onion skins, the layers of the onion skin, which are just parts of the shell that enclose and enclothe what is inside, what is it that we come to? When we come down to that center, when we come to the essence, we find it's pure consciousness, don't we? Pure consciousness, which, when uncovered, vanishes within itself. What does it do? It was trapped inside that onion. It expands when we take all of the shell loose. It expands, mingling with the greater consciousness, the infinite consciousness, the consciousness, the divine consciousness, which is inside everything. This is God. God is all, and God is in all. God is the root of all life. God is the holy spark within everything. Every grain of sand could not exist without the essence, the spark of divine consciousness, which is inside it. Every tree could not exist without the divine sparks within the tree. Every mountain wouldn't be there unless it had the divine spark of consciousness that says, I am. You see, nothing that is created exists in and of itself. Nothing. A tree doesn't exist by itself. A grain of sand doesn't exist on its own. Animals don't exist on their own. Human beings don't exist. We, you, me, none of us exist on our own. Withdraw that spark of divine consciousness that is housed within each and every thing in the universe and within each and every person, and the form, the shell, goes away. Don't think so? What happens to every mountain? What eventually happens to every mountain? Give it enough time. What happens to that mountain? It ends up as grains of sand on a beach. What happens to every grain of sand on the beach as they're rolled in the waves of the sea? The sea which washes ashore, washes up on the edges of the land. Well, that mountain, which was eroded down and became sand on that beach, all those little tiny particles of sand, those grains of sand, are rolled against each other with all of their hard edges, their shells, brushing against each other. What happens to them in enough time? They disappear, don't they? They become no more. They're not converted into something else. They don't change form. They become no more. Once that shell becomes thin enough and is removed, the essence, the divine essence, the soul of souls, the divine consciousness which is inside it and gave it its form, that vanishes within itself. It expands, mingling with the greater consciousness, joining with and returning to itself, the infinite consciousness from which it came. See, everything here is God now in physical form, with trapped divine consciousness in it to give it that manifestation of form. Ultimately, though, that divineness, that divinity, returns to the divinity from which it came, to Ein Sof, the transcendental, unknowable, ineffable God. When we die, what happens to us? Our bodies return to the elements from which they're made. Yeah, that's right. We preserve ourselves, pump formaldehyde and all kinds of other chemicals into our bodies because we got to keep those bodies available for the day of resurrection. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. ultimately, even the chemicals of preservation break down, and everything returns to the earth. We're told this in the Torah. From dust ye were made, and to dust ye shall ye return. No use fighting it. That's the way it is. God ordained it, and that's the way it is. Now, why am I telling you all of this? Because of the great chain of being, the great continuum of life. What we're going to teach about in the weeks and months to come is the method, the Lurianic description, the post-Lurianic Neo-Sabbatean description of the processes by which go on within the Godhead, by which God, who's transcendent, takes part of himself and makes it into a universe, creates a universe out of it with all of its being. The method by which God goes from non-being into being, from ayin, nothing, to something, no matter what that form is. So, that's all that I've got to teach today. That concludes today's teaching, and I hope that you've enjoyed it, and we will be repeating this broadcast tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific time, same place, and I hope that you will join us. And in the meantime, our next class, in which we start to get into the mechanics of this, will be on Wednesday, same time as today. And I hope that you'll come and that you'll bring your friends with you. And I look forward to seeing you then. In the meantime, don't forget to remember God at least twice each day. And may you go from strength to strength. Zygesund.